Call the meeting to order. Part of our responsibility is to appropriate money, and part of it is to make sure it is well spent. And so this is a well-spent meeting, I hope. We welcome Bowser to talk about Clean Water Fund outcomes to give us some perspective about how our clean water funding fits into the findings from the TMDLs and the other things we know about what are happening to our waters. So with that, welcome to Bowser, and if you all, Ms. Stroman, if you'll state your, I imagine you're going to start, state your name for the record, and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm the Acting Deputy Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Also here with me this morning is our Acting Assistant Director for Programs and Policy, Dave Wirens, and our Acting Assistant Director for Regional Operations, Doug Thomas. And we're very pleased to be here this morning to share some information about our Clean Water Fund programs and discuss the outcomes. Our focus will be on the 2014 appropriation. That's where we've been asked to focus, but we'll provide some larger context as well. So my role here this morning, I'm just going to briefly set the stage and provide a little bit of background. Mr. Wirens is going to walk through our Clean Water Fund grant and easement programs and talk about the outcomes there. And then Mr. Thomas will walk through our One Watershed, One Plan initiative, which also was the beneficiary of a Clean Water Fund appropriation past session. So our goal for the Clean Water Fund dollars that we receive in our Clean Water Fund programs is to help meet statewide water quality goals through the prevention and reduction of non-point source pollution. The majority of funds we get passed through our agency either via a competitive grant program or a conservation easement program. And so the competitive grant program works through the local conservation delivery system that includes counties, cities, watershed districts, soil and water districts, and to fund projects that are prioritized and targeted to the most critical source areas. Our Clean Water Fund easements provide permanent protection of private land in riparian and groundwater locations, resulting in improved surface water quality and the health and security of community water supplies. Just to set the stage a little bit here, this slide depicts an overview of all of the completed projects to date. So this is from 2010 to 2013. These are all completed projects, not projects that are yet in process. And so I'll give you an idea of the areas of the state in which we have funded projects. And I know the numbers are incredibly hard to read, but the green and blue numbers here also indicate the sediment reduction and the phosphorus reduction that we estimate has occurred as a result of these projects. We're going to go through this in more detail as we go through the specific programs. This is just to provide some high-level context. I also want to set the stage a little bit in terms of the importance of the Clean Water Fund programs to Bowser and how it fits into our overall agency budget. As you'll see from the pie chart on the left, the Clean Water Fund makes up about a third of the Bowser budget, so it is a significant portion of our budget. Again, the majority of those dollars do pass through the agency to our local partners through the local conservation delivery program. And if you'll look at the pie chart on the right, you'll see how that's divided up, with the vast majority going out via competitive grants for projects and practices, the next share going to conservation easements, and then the smaller portions going for the agency's administration and oversight of those programs. With that, now I'm going to turn it over to Dave Wirens, and he is going to walk through the specifics of the conservation easement programs and the competitive grant programs.
Good morning, Chair Regains, members of the committee. My name is Dave Wirens. I'm the Acting Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And first I'll start and spend a few moments talking about our Clean Water Fund easement programs before I move on and provide some information on our competitive grants and local implementation programs as well. So first off, as you see up on the slide are the appropriation for our two Clean Water Fund easement programs, the riparian buffer and the wildlife protection conservation easement program. And the total amount we have available, as you see, is in just under $8 million for those two programs for fiscal year 14. First off, in terms of the riparian buffer program, the map you see in front of you, the blue dots are easements that have already been acquired through these programs. The red dots are ones that we have made commitments to with the FY14 dollars. They've not been executed easements yet, but we made commitments to landowners that we will acquire those easements going forward. The process that we use to select these easements is we do work through these stormwater conservation districts. They are our primary partners at the local level to implement these programs. We do have discrete sign-up periods where we ask for folks to offer their land for this program. In terms of the important criteria for the riparian buffer, they must be adjacent to streams, lakes, ditches, and intermittent streams. So obviously riparian means close to water. We do have a minimum size of 50 feet. Up to 350 feet are the boundaries of the width that we will accept. In terms of priority, the wider the buffer, the better. We make a priority for those. We get a larger buffer strip. That way we also get the water quality benefits, but we also get the habitat benefits with you to larger buffers.
Excuse me for just a second. Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to do questions as we go through the testimony, or are we going to wait to the end?
I think in this case we want to have a conversation, so it's better if you have a question to go right ahead.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt the presenter, but as part of your remarks, could you indicate the demand compared to how many you can actually fund? I'm making an assumption here that you're getting more applications than you can possibly fund, and I'd just like to have an idea of how much demand there is.
Let me ask Bill Ping, our easement manager, to provide that context for you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Bill Penning. I'm the Conservation Easement Section Manager at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We stopped taking applications when we had a backlog of $10 million in applications in our office, and we estimate that there were another $10 million in applications that were sitting out in SWCD offices that had not been submitted yet. We shook loose combined Clean Water Fund and Outdoor Heritage Fund about $5 million a few weeks ago, and it was gone in 2 days. The demand far exceeds the supply for this program. It's very popular with landowners.
As you were giving context, when we're talking about the buffers areas, I mean, I've seen charts of where we have immense numbers of buffers, but we've only completed what portion? Do you have a number for that? I mean, what's the context here? He's asked the context of how much is the demand, and I'm asking the context of, well, what's the big picture here?
Madam Chair, members, it sort of depends upon how you calculate that, and I don't have a good number for that. Certainly, the buffers program is something that is a long-term strategy to put permanent conservation on the ground. In terms of the number of river, stream, and ditch miles that actually have buffers on them, I actually can't answer that question right now.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Penning, you alluded to there's the shared funding of both Outdoor Heritage and Clean Water. Is the map in front of us only Clean Water Funds, or is it the aggregated total?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is Clean Water Funds only. However, many of those have two sources of funding where it's actually leveraging Outdoor Heritage Funds. So we go up to 350 feet wide for an OHF buffer and up to 700 feet for the extension for the Outdoor Heritage Funds.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Penning, you testified that there's a backlog of $10 million, and even a fresh application that it went in two days. So are you seeing any consequence of any tax law changes suppressing demand if you are having people sign up in 2 days and use up all the money?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a bit of a difficult question at this point. We hear anecdotal information about some landowners that are holding off on submitting applications, particularly for some of our other programs that might be more relevant where the parcel size is larger. With buffers, they tend to be smaller parcels, so I don't think that the impact would be quite so great. Additionally, the way the tax law that was passed last session was written, if the easement is for water quality or water quantity management, it would be exempt from that, and the tax assessor may reduce the value.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Penning, and so the Department of Revenue guidance enhances the program because it goes back to prior the status quo. So there should be no impact on riparian buffers, and again, there's a $10 million backlog right now.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct.
If you want to continue on this, I think we will. This is a conversation, so we are all making sure we do our job the best we can do. So if you want to continue.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add one comment on that. Your question on the context of how many buffers are sort of needed and where are we in that process. We have in the past done some very coarse work on a watershed scale to try to understand how much of the area that is riparian is still in agriculture versus permanent cover. And one of our goals moving forward, in fact, our staff has started to scope out a project, is to really look at a long-term buffer strategy so that we can understand in a little bit more refined way what the needs are and how much of the needs we're addressing with our program. So our goal, I think, is the same where you were headed with that question. We're just not quite there yet. The science and the data take some time together.
Well, I appreciate that you are working on this, and we're all fans of buffers, no question about it. However, the nitrogen report that we were given says that that runoff is only 5% of the nitrogen problem that we have. So in context, we obviously have bigger that buffers aren't going to solve our water problems. They can solve 5% of it. So as we're allocating money, that's something else we need to keep in mind, that perhaps we have to choose our buffers rather than let the applications come in and choose the ones that will have the best bang for the public buck, since we're only dealing with buffers with 5% of at least the nitrogen runoff problem, which is the problem that we have that's increasing. So with that, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. And my question is along those same lines. You know, it's a matter of prioritization. And I'm curious, how do you prioritize which buffers are the most important ones to fund? Do you base it on location or water impacts, or how do you do that?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I'm going to let Mr. Penning talk about how we fund the application.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, right now, there are minimum criteria that need to be met, and if an application comes in and it meets the minimum criteria, then it's funded. It's kind of a first come, first serve. As demand is ramped up for this program, we are looking at doing some sort of a scoring procedure where we would rank them and then fund only the highest ranked applications.
Thank you. And Chair Wagenius brought up the nitrogen issue, which certainly is a is an important one, but it's not the only one. And how do we determine which of the water quality issues is the most important to deal with as we're looking at buffers and other practices?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I'm not entirely sure that I can answer that question. That's kind of a tough one. You know, we also with RIM, we also try to combine habitat benefits and other things beyond water quality too. Although with Clean Water Fund, that's primarily a water quality program. But you're right. I mean, there are many issues. This can also, you know, buffers can also help moderate quantity of water as well as quality of water. There's a whole bunch of things, which is kind of why when the program was originally developed, there was sort of minimum criteria that were set with the idea that when we were first getting going, kind of any buffer was a good buffer.
Ma'am, if I just add to Mr. Peng's response as well, I think the in terms of, you know, the water quality functions that the buffers provide, which I believe was the backdrop of your question, Representative Torkelson, you know, is, you know, the purpose that the buffers provide obviously is filtration, where, you know, filter out the sediment and the phosphorus that is attached to it. And as the nitrogen strategy talks about as well too, is having a permanent cover is also going to help manage on the side of how we manage the nitrogen. So it provides benefits kind of across the board. But certainly the point is well taken, is that not all buffers are created equal, and better locations maximize those benefits.
Yes, it does seem to me at this point, with the demand being, you know, high, and we'll never have enough money, for one, and secondly, that while we all love buffers, I think we were all also taken aback to find that they were only 5% of at least the nitrogen problem, and I take that to be the runoff problem. So, and maybe I'm wrong about that, and that's fine, but it does seem at this point that we need some fairly sophisticated criteria as we go forward. And how long do you think it would take to develop those?
Madam Chair, members, we could probably get those developed this summer yet. We've got some ideas on how to do this. I would also point out that Mr. Wirens is going to get to a slide here in a minute that talks about recommendations on the best ways to reduce nitrogen from the nitrogen study, and the top two ways are through permanent grass.
Okay, just one other thing before you get going on this. As you mentioned that obviously money from the Clean Water Fund is for water, in all the funds we're looking for multiple benefits, mm-hmm. and that's a high criteria, and how some of these funds can work together. I think there is a desire on all parties to get that have all the funds work together. And if I'm wrong about that, I'm sure somebody will jump in and say I'm wrong. So, if you want to continue,
Ms. Bell. As Mr. Peng was just discussing, we do have a couple slides that do talk about some of the outcomes of the riparian buffer programs that we do in fact implement. What these slides show, charts show in terms of chemistry and biology, where we're looking at on the left-hand side the phosphorus and nitrogen monitoring that as you increase the amount of land that is set aside in easement programs, the environmental benefits increase. On the right-hand slide, that shows the indicators of biological integrity, is that again, as the amount of land set aside through easements goes up, the IBI scores increase as well too. So just kind of showing a documented benefit and outcomes, and some work that has been done to start to identify some of the outcomes of the buffers that we in fact are implementing. And as Mr. Penning had described, some information from the PCA nitrogen study that they came out with last year is, again, just to identify the fact that that land that is that goes from riparian corn to grass, as well as that is in perennials, really provide the largest reduction in nitrogen as compared to other treatment methodologies as well. But certainly, as we'll talk about later on with our competitive grants program, is we view the opportunities between our easement programs and our grant programs as a way of maximizing kind of across the board benefit of projects as well as permanent land set aside. The other program spent a few moments on are the wellhead protection easement program.
Just before you go on with that, when that nitrogen study was being done, we had not had conversations yet about pollinators. And so as you are looking at how you're doing easements, I think a discussion of how you also work on the pollinator issue would be important. We didn't hear anything about that.
Yep, and Madam Chair and members, that wasn't the focus of our conversation here today, but as Dan Shaw testified in committee earlier, or I guess last week, we are working very diligently to address the pollinator issue across all of Bowser's programs, and easements being a primary focus of those efforts. So we will continue that work.
The Wellhead Protection Program is a smaller easement program that we had. We've been working with the Department of Health, because as the appropriation does require that, the areas that are eligible must be designated as high or very high as a wellhead protection area, as termed by the Department of Health. We do give priority to land that's being cropped, again, to try and protect the drinking water sources. That's the purpose of a wellhead protection area. And as you see from the screen is that we've had just over 1,000 acres with 16 easements over the life of this particular program. And in terms of where we're going with this, this is something we recognize. It is a small program, so we have to be, of course, realistic on these expected outcomes. But we just started some discussions with the Department of Health of how we improve the effectiveness of the program to make sure that we are targeting it to the highest priority areas. And we do expect some changes to houses to run going forward as well.
Again, I think we need some sort of context here. I mean, how many acres is health saying? I have no idea from this. How many acres should we be worried about should be in wellhead protection programs? Do you have a number?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. The area in the state that are within highly and very highly vulnerable wellhead protection areas is approximately 350,000 acres.
350,000?
Yes.
That's large compared with what we're seeing. Okay. The second thing is health, I think much to the surprise of a lot of us, is only looking at a 10-year travel time for water pollution, which is a very a standard that was developed a long time ago and doesn't fit today, and obviously needs to be updated, which means that acreage is going to go up. So are you working with health on that particular issue?
Madam Chair, at this time, the way the program is structured is that the Department of Health is the one that sets the standards, and we carry that out. We've not been directly in contact to work with them on how they define a wellhead protection area. That's more directly in their responsibility.
Madam Chair, I might just add where we have been working with the Department of Health is on how we can better define or focus this program, understanding there's 350,000 acres and we have completed 1,000 of those to date. And as you pointed out, that's a small number compared to the total. I think part of the other challenge with this program is While the rest of our rim easements have been aimed at marginal agricultural land, these wellhead areas tend to fall in highly productive agricultural land. And so the program has not been as competitive in these areas as it has been in other areas, in particular with the high agricultural land prices that we've seen recently. And so we have started the conversations with the Department of Health, not necessarily, as Mr. Wyron said, on the how they define those areas, but within that, is there some other way to look at this to make the protection, which is, I think, important, the permanent protection of drinking water supply areas, but to target and focus that so that we can be more effective in this program.
Well, I think you do have an expertise, or at least you tell us you have an expertise, and I believe you, that you need to share with the Department of Health on this, because the $350,000 is not the right number. That's under old think. And so if this is drinking water and citizens drinking water, that should be one of our top priorities, not one of our low priorities. In fact, statewide, that is, drinking water is our number one priority. So I think we need to have you all come back to us with some other suggestions about how we deal with this particular drinking water issue, working with the Department of Health.
And Madam Chair, members, we would be happy to do that as we continue our conversations with the Department of Health and come up with some different answers. I think, you know, the point here is we've realized we probably need to shift our focus a little bit on this instead of continuing to have this program funded at, you know, $2 million a year. We need to figure out something different. So we'd be happy to come back and talk with you about ideas that we've generated through those discussions.
That would be very helpful.
All right, let's move on to our competitive grants and local invitation programs. What you see in front of you here on this screen, on this slide, are the dollars have been appropriated to the board for fiscal year 14 across our seven granting program categories. And we'll discuss each of these in turn in following slides as we move through the presentation this morning. First off, in terms of the process we use, we spend a lot of time at the board in trying to make sure that we are selecting projects that are prioritized and targeted to address specific pollutants, and also that obviously you can have a measurable outcome as well. And for each of those seven programs, we do have different criteria that we use because each program has a different purpose, therefore the selection criteria are all somewhat different. What you see in front of you are the criteria used for our project and practices program, the largest one of them. These are projects that are geared towards doing work on the ground to address a specific water quality a threat or to target a restoration. And as you see, based upon the pie chart in front of you, is that the primary criteria that drive the selection process that we run through are the measurable outcomes. You know, we have the applicants estimate the projected impact of a reduction of pollutants, and the degree to which the activities are being targeted. Again, if you target well, you get better measurable outcomes, and those are the primary, the largest share of our scoring process that we in fact run through. The other thing I think is important to keep in mind about the scoring process we run through is the criteria are important, but this is a scoring that for most of our programs we involve our partner agencies as well, the Department of Ag, Department of Health, PCA, and DNR. We all invite them to help us in making these selections because we know that when it comes to clean water work, our biggest part of the work is implementation, but we need to draw on the expertise of our partner agencies to make sure we are getting the best projects in the best locations to achieve the water quality goals that we all have. In terms of supply and demand, we have consistently seen over the life of our clean water work that the amount of dollar requests is far in excess of the available funds. I feel very comfortable in saying that every year, and this year I think more so than prior years, we are leaving, you know, good projects on the table that will make a water quality difference that we just do not have the resources to fund. But we make the best we can with the dollars available, and that's what this chart in fact shows, are the fact that we get a tremendous response from our local government partners, and we go through the process to choose the best ones.
Well, with this, given the competitive nature and the fact that we all acknowledge that we don't have enough money, there's not enough state money, and there never will be, why are we not raising the amount of local contribution to make sure we can spread the money further among more communities?
Madam Chair, the question of local match is one we wrestle with every single year that we are thinking about our next year's programs, how we're going to operate them. The challenge we face with that is there are some local governments that have the ability to generate a fair amount of match, and others that have a more difficult time, in fact, doing that. The concern we have is that if we raise the match too high, the concern you have is that a poor community may not have the opportunity to participate in these programs. So that's the balance point. We certainly recognize that we want to get as much, you know, non-state money into the mix because it does make the money go further. We certainly understand that as well. But it comes a balance point of the varying economic conditions that extend around the state and the ability that, that some local governments have a more difficult time in generating that, that local match share.
Okay, well, recognizing that some local governments cannot participate at the level that others can, why wouldn't you have a several-tiered system then so that, I mean, that communities that don't have the base can participate on the same footing that a community that has a large base, say my county, for example, which would have a large base, but why wouldn't we have those grants have a higher local match? Because we are not, I mean, everybody is recognizing we're not going to have the funds to meet the demand, I mean, in the buffers, and now we've got it in the competitive grants, and we don't have it in the wellhead. So is there another way to structure rather than a one-size-fits-all? Is that something that you all could come back and have a conversation with us about?
Madam Chair, we certainly can do that. I think the other consideration that we'd have in mind with that is the added complexity you have with a program of that nature. But we certainly can take a closer look at a different way of looking at local match and the financial wherewithal of different parts of the state.
Well, I understand the added complexity, but we have got to figure out a way to stretch these dollars further. I mean, that's they're not. We're just going to have to do it. I mean, if all these people are funds requested, so we're just discriminating actually against some folks because we don't have the funds. So how are we going to say not this first come first serve group gets the funds? It doesn't, the fairness there doesn't quite seem right.
Yeah, and Madam
that
Chair,
that was in the easement portion, and I don't know that this is first come first serve. I think you're doing the best, but still, as I understand it, you wanted to go further down the list, and if I'm correct about that, then perhaps we have to figure out a way to stretch these funds further.
Right, and Madam Chair, members, as Mr. Warren said, we can certainly take a look at that. You know, I think there's some other factors that complicate it. As you point out, your county, for example, can afford more projects within.
Don't tell my county I said that.
Yeah, no, I won't. Are they here? But I think, you know, there is more financial capacity in parts of the state. In those areas, it also typically costs more to get projects done, and so typically they are bringing more match just to get the project done. And so I think we'll have to factor those elements into this approach as well. I think another issue that we have to factor in is just how we sustain capacity over time, because we don't need folks on the ground just during this period of the projects. I mean, we need sustained capacity over time, I think, to address these issues. So how we raise up the local capacity, not just for the match, but to implement, to have the technical capacity as well, is something that we wrestle with as well. So, you know, again, we continue to look at all these issues and would be happy to come back and share our evolving ideas on them.
Well, I think it might be just helpful to know where in that you've got all the projects and say, well, this is the line where we draw the line for quality. Above that line, these are good projects, and we're not funding them, so there's a gap there. So it would be helpful for you all to come back and talk to us about that, because this is going to be an ongoing problem. You can feel it. Okay, if you want to go ahead.
Next, I want to spend a few moments talking about the outcomes and how we measure and talk about outcomes in the context of our projects. Again, we're talking about the fiscal year 14 appropriation, so there are no actual outcomes at this point in time. However, the board has approved, you know, a slate of projects in January, and at the front end, as part of the application process, we require all the applicants to estimate. We have tools available that applicants can estimate the projected pollutant reduction of the activities that they are in fact proposing. And what you see in front of you is the range of outcomes that we see in the projects we've approved, from a 1% of a water quality goal to a 6% towards the goal. Now, the other thing that we do, just to kind of cap that process, we also, when the projects are done, is for the applicants to go back and run those same estimators based upon the actual that was done, so that we have a higher value estimate of that reduction at the tail end of the project. Because, as you know, not every project is the same in the back end as in the front end, so we make sure they do it on both ends, they propose as well as what actually happens. What you see in front of you here, though, is that one of the challenges of talking about outcomes is the fact that the degree of reduction can vary in a number of ways. It can depend upon the pollutant, the scale of a project. Again, if you're addressing the St. Croix River versus Comfort Lake, a much smaller body of water, the percent reduction can be quite variable as far as that goes. But they're still making all progress towards addressing the water quality goals and moving us forward. The next slide that also talks about pollutant reductions and about the work that we've been financing. What this slide shows are the goals as provided in the draft nutrient reduction strategy, mm-hmm. and again applying the estimated reductions in.
Excuse me for a second. Representative Hansen, is your question?
I just was looking at the bar chart and I'd like you to address how we can ever achieve the goals in an incentive-based paying people to do the right thing model.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, the numbers you see here again are a snapshot in time, a single year. And what the actual percents are is a 2% in phosphorus, and that's under 1% for nitrogen. You probably could, you know, figure it out by looking at those particular bar charts. I think the way in which we can address your question, it gets back to making sure again that when we're choosing projects, not every project proposes equal of government. Some achieve a greater reduction than others. And over time, we are going to make a difference in the water quality. And our goal is working through local governments. And I think the work that Mr. Thompson discussed about the Washington Plan, again, is through better planning and using the data by other agencies, we think we can make a measurable reduction in water quality or improve water quality across the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wyburns, is Bowser working through the soil and water districts in the counties willing to say we're going to do the worst first, and that means some counties aren't going to receive any funds, that we'll just throw everything we have into extremely targeted projects in a specific watershed? And that, I mean, we just don't have the money to pour it everywhere. So, can you do that? Will you do that?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, we are currently doing that. If you look at let's go back to just a few minutes here. In terms of the criteria that we use, the primary way we choose projects are through targeting, project location, and measurable outcomes. Those are primary ways that determine where projects are going. And in fact, the fact that we are only funding a small proportion of applications, I think we do communicate very clearly to local governments that you have to have an excellent project that's going to achieve a high degree of reduction overall in order to achieve funding, because they are extremely competitive funds. There are a lot of governments that we hear about every year that want to know how they can do better, because they want to address water quality within their areas. They want to be on the maps when we're talking to you and other folks about the progress that we're working to make in water quality.
Let me put Representative Hansen's question in a different way. If we are solving less than 1% of just two of the pollutants in this year, then over 25 years, and given the TMDLs, nobody's even mentioned the TMDLs, but given the frame of the TMDLs and what they're finding, over 25 years, we're not going to, with this approach, funding only, and with some of the pollutants increasing, will we maybe solve 5% of the problem, 2% of the problem? I'm guessing it's going to be between 1 and 5, and I'd love you to prove me wrong, but I'm worried that you can't. So when you look at over all these years, and Minnesotans believe they have a promise of cleaner water, it doesn't feel that we're going to be able to meet that promise.
Well,
can you tell me that I am wrong in saying that it's going to be way less than 5% of the problem solved with this approach?
Well, Madam Chair, I think we have to obviously speak to the facts as they are. I'd like to say you're wrong, but I think the facts in the map here on the chart keep to tell you the story. But a couple things I would say in addition to that is to keep in mind is what you see here, these are Bowser-only actions. There are other agencies that are doing work that are not represented here as well. So the actual numbers are going to be different than what you see here. This is through our work and through our appropriations. The other thing is that, in looking back over the first 4 years of the Clean Water Fund the information we've gathered through our process, about 5% of the phosphorus goal has been met so far under our work. So this 2%, it's a 1 year goal, but you have to kind of add it to your prior years in terms of trying to get an idea of what the total impact is going to be over time.
But we have phosphorus and nitrogen and sediment and all sorts of other projects, and we haven't even talked any pollutant that's been identified since 1970. So we're still talking about 1970. So I think we need, when you talk about the agencies working together, even with all the other agency projects, I still don't see more than 5%. And I would love it if you guys would prove me wrong, but I read your nitrogen, clean water report last night, this one, and I was thinking 5% was a real generous, that's probably way beyond what will really happen given our current trajectory. So these are conversations that I think we need to have, how we get the job done.
Madam Chair, members, and I'll just add one quick comment here. I think The way that we have rolled this up, we've done it this way to provide some context, and you know, I think it's good job. and it's really the best we can do right now. I think there are some challenges to this, in that how do we fold in all of the activities that are going on at the local level, you know, the ones that are funded by Bowser, the ones that are happening through other agencies. This is a difficult way to take a few local actions and roll them up statewide. One of our goals, and you'll hear more about this from Mr. Thomas as he explains One Watershed, One Plan, is to move to this watershed approach where PCA has these watershed restoration and protection strategies that are very focused, that help describe the problem and where we need to target on a watershed scale. And then we have local watershed plans that describe the implementation. I think that will give us a much more useful framework going forward to understand the problem and understand how much we're achieving, as well as help us focus and target so that we get the maximum results that we're looking for. And so maybe we can revisit this conversation when Mr. Thomas comes up and talks a little bit about One Watershed, One Plan and where we're going. Because I think this is helpful, but I also think it's a little bit limited.
We do have to have context, and we're just beginning to understand context, so I understand that this is the first shot at it, and for that, I am grateful. Thank you. And we have to do more. But since this is the implementing agency and there's not much implementation going on from anybody else, I still think we're less than 5%, and I'm hoping somebody proves me wrong. Do you want to continue?
All right, in terms of our largest implementation program, the project and practices, the maps you've read here are we had over $8 million available. This map shows you the funded projects in the outstate non-metro portion of the state, showing you where the funds are going, and the probably hard to read on your map, but again, about $3 million in those identified local government areas across the state. In the metro area, I think the scale is different, but I think we just to kind of show you the about $5 million is funded to metro area projects in the fiscal year 14. And the blue areas are not lakes, just to make sure you're clear, those are watershed districts. Just we make sure that I have the context. In terms of the project and practices, again, to give you some idea of the estimated outcomes from the projects, again, we funded 40 projects, 28 address impairments as listed by the MPCA. And the numbers you see there is about 18,000 pounds of phosphorus reduction on an annual basis, 18,000 tons of sediment, and just under 5,000 pounds of nitrogen are the estimated reductions from these projects. And again, the estimate on the front end before they do the work, and then they'll estimate on the back end after done the work, so that we have a better idea of the actual work that was accomplished with these funds. We want to give you a few examples of the projects that were awarded funds with the FY14 funds. The first one is the Serpent Lake Protection Project up in Crow Wing County. Serpent Lake is a lake east of Brainerd, has cities of Crosby, Ironton, Deerwood are on this particular lake. This is a protection project. It is not impaired, but it is trending downward through the declining water quality trend was actually identified in a large lake assessment funded through Clean Water Legacy Funds back in 2008. So this is a follow-on work that we have helped to bring forward. The purpose of the project is to reverse, again, the declining water quality trend by installing a series of bioretention swales and iron-enhanced filters on public and private land. As you see, the goal is to reduce the amount of phosphorus by 27 pounds per year. That's been identified as the primary pollutant that is resulting in the declining water quality trend. And the goal of the SWCD is to get ahead of that so that it does not become an impaired water. The next project, different part of the state, the Red River Valley Sediment Reduction Project. This is a Wilkin Stormwater Conservation District project, and the purpose of what they're doing is to repair severe gullies that are contributing to significant sediment loads to the Red River. They are estimating about 1,200 tons of sediment per year to be reduced through the construction of grade stabilization structures to stabilize the areas and to prevent the sediment from going into the Red River. The next project is a NOCA Conservation District project, the Oakland Creek Stormwater Pond. The purpose of the Oakland area is it's an urbanized area.
Excuse me, Representative Hamilton has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, you bring up a good point, and we're talking about the various agencies, about the work that they're doing. Do we have a list of all the agencies, local, state, and federal, that are working on water quality, the total dollar amounts, the programs, and the outcomes? Is that, you know, because we hear the individual work that's being done. Is there any information out there talking about the collective? And
I have an extra copy. I'll give it to you. This is all the Clean Water Fund, so it's all of the agencies.
Okay.
So it's not just Bowser. Now, in terms of federal, I'm talking about state. I think this gives a good state snapshot.
Yeah.
But for federal and local, I think maybe these folks can give you a better sense.
Okay. And then one other thing. Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, you're talking about targeting the various programs. I was talking to a young farmer who I believe was from Stevens County. And he was critical because what he was saying was a neighboring landowner. I mean, it was their rights, right? I guess they chose to do this, but they enrolled full sections of land into the various programs that were available to take the farmland out of production. And this young guy was saying now he's going to have to travel, you know, 10 miles or further to try to find land to be able to rent and continue farming. And this was a few years ago. And he was very critical of why not be able to target the various programs specifically to the highly erodible land or the wellhead protection agencies or the wellhead protection areas, and versus taking highly productive farm ground that isn't in the sensitive areas, taking that out of production, but being very specific in targeting. Now, this was a few years ago when I talked to him, so maybe there had been some changes, but could you speak to that as well?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, the way you describe the program just sounds more like an easement program than the clean water projects that I'm discussing here today. But what I'd say, though, is that it really depends upon the purposes of the program. The easement programs, you know, the Reinvest Minnesota, the Conservation Reserve, you know, I think our primary purpose of those does tend to be for wildlife habitat, and larger land areas do provide a better habitat benefit, and the water quality does tend to be secondary for those sorts of activities. So that's, I mean, just trying to see if I can understand kind of the nature of the work that was done there. That's sort of what seems to me is going on. And again, you want to have larger land areas for the habitat benefit. And that speak to, you know, perhaps little sections or larger chunks that were that are acquired through those programs.
Thank you,
Representative Hamilton. One of my concerns is with, I mean, I'm a fan of the habitat programs, but some of them don't have the multiple benefits of water quality, and that. Particularly some of our easements don't. And we don't have a standard writing for easements that includes this. So in terms of bang for the buck, I am concerned and always wanting us to do better in this. But you can't do better unless you have a meeting like this and discuss what's going on.
Thank you.
And just to continue, just again a brief overview of this project up in the city of Fridley. This is a project area where there is the discharge to the from this Oakland in the Mississippi River, just upstream of the Fridley water intake as well. The purpose of the project is to expand the stormwater pond and enhance with an iron sand filter. To stabilize the downstream corridor and improve the quality of stormwater discharge into the Mississippi River. Again, you see from the bar chart on there, it's projected to remove over 100 pounds of phosphorus per year, and you know over 20 tons of sediment as well through this particular project to address this water quality problem. Again, in a heavily urbanized part of the metropolitan area. Next, talk about one of our new programs for this current fiscal year. One of the current concerns that we have is the capacity of local governments to develop and implement the quality projects that we all spent out of our clean water funds. And one of the initiatives that we started this year is through through the technical service areas. These are joint powers boards of some of our conservation districts. As you can see, they operate on a statewide basis. And the purpose of these funds are to create that additional capacity to work with their local governments to further develop projects, to improve the targeting so that they can, again, address the water quality concerns that exist within their parts of the state. In terms of the example I want to spend a moment on here is in southeast Minnesota in the technical service area number 7. One of the goals that they have down there is to work with their producers on grazing and cover crops. Beef cattle and livestock and dairy is a important part of agriculture in southeast Minnesota, and with their steep slopes, to the extent they can keep cover on the land, they can help reduce the runoff and the sedimentation erosion that comes along with that. The expected output for this project and is work with over 50 producers a year to adopt cover crop practices. And again, the nitrogen study, one of the things they spoke to is that having perennial cover will have benefits for nitrogen reduction as well. The accelerated implementation grants, this is another program. It's very similar to the one I just discussed. This is on a broader basis, a competitive program, again, where we ask local governments, again, to give us proposals for how do they prepare for again, their continued work to target, identify, and develop projects that will address priority water quality concerns. The map you see in front of you here, again, are the accelerated implementation grants in the non-metro part of the state, just under $2 million made available for these grants. In the metro area, about 400,000 of these particular grants to work on projects. The one example that we want to speak to here that I think is kind of exciting is work that the Middle St. Croix Watershed Management Organization is being funded just over $127,000 to work with up to 13 communities in the St. Croix River Basin to adopt ordinances and code revisions to incorporate minimal impact design standards. The goal they have here is to get these communities to adopt these standards, make them part of their zoning codes so that they can provide permanent and ongoing protection of the St. Croix River as development and redevelopment occurs within their communities. This is actually built on work the PCA has done, but again, it taken from the state work of the PCA and to be a bridge to have local adoption and ongoing implementation.
On this one, for a small amount of money, relatively speaking, it looks like you're going to have a longer term, bigger bang for the buck. Have you all suggested to other communities that they do something like this? Are you doing any outreach and education to feature something like this? This one, I would agree with you. There should be some excitement about this one.
Well, Madam Chair, we certainly always encourage all governments to do this kind of work because the best way to address water quality problems is to take a little more control over it. This kind of thing is going to do through development work. Certainly through the water planning process that our staff work with, we certainly encourage them to look at not just voluntary conservation, but what else can they do to address their water quality concerns. And this sort of work on ordinance is always part of that conversation. It's kind of one of the variable tools in the toolbox that's available to local governments to address their water quality concerns.
Well, this tool is a particularly handy one. Mm-hmm. So had you thought about setting aside some of your money for just funding this kind of tool, which may have longer term for a small amount of money, bigger benefits?
Madam Chair and members, that is largely what this accelerated implementation category is about. It's about things that are not projects and practices, but are about helping communities, you know, bring their own tools to the table to either target or, in this case, develop ordinances. Couple other comments. One is we do try to feature these kinds of stories via Bowser's communication materials and also assist the local governments who are engaging in these projects to publicize them as well in the hopes that, you know, others will become interested in them. And then finally, and I know that Dave is going to get to our targeted watershed program, which those grants aren't yet awarded, but one of the things that we built into the selection process for those was an item for watersheds that had some kind of governance structure or these kind of had thought about these sustainability issues. And so how do we sustain efforts over time and get the bigger bang for the buck, as you've noted? So we are looking at opportunities to integrate these.
Super. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This question may be a little bit off target, but when I saw the word stormwater, I thought about this. Any studies or any indications as to the amount of salt that every winter that's used in cities and counties and countrysides, the amount of salt that we see that's deposited into stormwater and winds up in our river system? Has anything been done about seeing how much that would amount to?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Harris, I don't have asked that question, but I do know there are one or more impairments in the metropolitan area due to salt, but I cannot give you more detailed information in terms of salt. That's probably a question that the Pollution Control Agency would have a better handle on in terms of the effects of salt, of road salt use on water quality.
We can ask them. Go ahead.
All right. The next program, spend a few moments on our Community Partners Conservation Program grants. This is a program where we make grants to local governments who in turn develop a sub-granting program to work with community partners, chambers of commerce, lakes associations, you know, these local groups that also want to address water quality concerns within their particular communities. The map you see in front of you are the grants that were made for fiscal year 14, the areas of the state that we are making these grants to. Again, one example in Otter Tail, there are two sonar conservation districts in Otter Tail County, and both of those are going to work principally through lake associations to identify projects that can be used to restore and protect lakes within their particular communities. Again, the purposes of the Community Partners Program is to reduce storm runoff and retain water on the land. Both those sorts of activities can have direct benefits to lake water quality. Mm-hmm. The Soil Erosion and Drainage Law Compliance Program grants, this is a new program for this current biennium. About $1.3 million of funds were made available. Again, the map shows you the distribution of grants. A pretty good spread across the state in terms of where the money is in fact going. The purpose of the project to be funded, they will address soil loss and highly erodible land. They'll do compliance checks on landowners with how they're implementing their highly erodible loss plans, finance development conservation plans, adopt erosion control ordinance, a whole variety of activities that deal with soil loss and drainage activities. Both activities that affect water quality across the state. The example project is the Pennington Sunwater Conservation District. What they're planning on doing is conduct an inventory of priority sites where they have priority sites where site water in the controls can have benefits for water quality within Pennington County, as well as where buffer strips may have some benefit there as well too. Again, this is a new program. Watching closely how it works in practice as the projects get rolling. The last program that's the least furthest along is our Targeted Watershed Demonstration Program. This is one where we had our application period ran from October through December. And we are planning on going to our board here this month to recommend they award grant funds to the chosen watersheds and to the sponsoring local units of government. As you see, the amount of demand was very high. We had about $5 million available in fiscal year 14, over $45 million worth of projects, a lot of interest. And then the purpose of the Tarta Watershed Program, and we're running it as a demonstration at this point in time, because we want to test how this model works with an eye towards, if it works well, continuing on in the future. But the purpose of this is to look at is to have the local governments identify a series of actions that in combination can achieve a measurable reduction in pollutants within the chosen water body that's part of the project. So we're quite excited again to see how this program rolls out. We had a very dramatic response from local governments, and we are intending to run a second selection round this coming summer with the fiscal year 15 funds. And with that, Madam Chair, I am done with my part of it, but I'll stick around for questions or something and turn over to Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. Good presentation. Helpful.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Doug Thomas, Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm going to give a brief update on the One Watershed, One Plan initiative. It started in 2012 with legislation that was passed that basically gave Bowser the authority to develop a comprehensive watershed management plan approach that could serve as then a substitute or a replacement for the 200-plus existing plans of soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, counties, and metropolitan water management organizations, with the goal of getting to around 100 or less, so going from many based on political boundaries to plans based on watershed boundaries around the state. A lot of emphasis was added to the importance of One Watershed, One Plan, and that started really in 2013 with the water governance evaluation that was led by Commissioner Stein from the Pollution Control Agency, and in that recommended that the One Watershed, One Plan legislation is the preferred option for local water management outside the metropolitan area. That was followed in the spring of 2013 with passage of the Clean Water Accountability Act, and again another document and another piece of legislation that really emphasized the importance of watershed management and making plans that are prioritized, targeted, and measurable, and you'll hear me use those terms repeatedly. The last thing that occurred in 2013 was this: at a high level, the state agencies kind of developing the water management framework that's envisioned really based on the 10-year watershed approach that PCA developed, recognizing we've got ongoing implementation, but then once every 10 years, the Pollution Control Agency going into one of the major watersheds, doing 2 years of intense monitoring, followed by 2 years of inventory assessment, and then developing a watershed restoration and protection strategy. So, dealing with both restoration and protection. But really then the linchpin in that is those strategy documents are to inform the comprehensive local water management activities of our local governments in the state, those people that are out there doing a lot of the implementation and the projects that were just described. And so again, added that element of emphasis to the One Watershed, One Plan program. In 2013, the legislature appropriated $900,000 from the Clean Water Fund, and that was to provide assistance and grants to local governments to help in this transition of local water management plans to this watershed approach, which we again are calling One Watershed, One Plan. The concept of One Watershed, One Plan is really built around a framework that includes three things. One is the existing authorities that Bowser has for soil and water district comprehensive plans, county local water planning, watershed district water management plans, and the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act and those plans that are done there. Also built around 9 guiding principles that the board adopted. And then lastly, that these plans are informed by this body of work that exists, the watershed restoration and protection strategies as they develop and come online, Certainly local knowledge and information. Existing TMDLs that we have, such as the Lake Pepin, Minnesota River, as well as very small-scale TMDLs, all of the local plans that we have, as well as state plans, things like this state nutrient reduction strategy, the Department of Ag's nitrogen management plan, wellhead protection plan. So it also is designed to really encompass and have all of those inform the local effort. So I want to just take a moment and talk about some of the outcomes. Again, we're in the development of One Watershed, One Plan, but our expected outcomes is one, first and foremost, we'll create a shared understanding of the definitions of what we mean when we talk about prioritized, targeted, and measurable at a watershed scale. Come to and develop agreed upon methods and tools for actually how to implement that concept within each watershed as it embarks and develops a One Watershed, One Plan in the future as we move forward. Having each of those plans establish water quality goals and targets by parameter of concern at the sub-watershed level, and then also identifying specific strategies and actions needed to achieve those established restoration and protection strategies and targets. We expect those plans will also include both short-term and long-term quantifiable milestones, things like you saw in the nutrient reduction strategy, where it sets a percent of a goal over a period of time, both short-term and long-term, such as phosphorus or nitrogen. Those plans will also identify the implementing authorities, establish timelines, cost estimates based on those milestones of what they expect to achieve in the short term and the long term for those pollutants, restoration strategies, or protection strategies. Again, the goal is to go from 200 plus plans based on largely on political boundaries to less than 100 plans based on watershed boundaries. And then lastly, to be able to serve to coordinate the collection, ranking, and submission of requests for funding of state and other resources. By having all of this done at the watershed level, those plans being comprehensive, linking surface water and groundwater together, having the ability to maybe have those serve as a framework to build up projects that relate directly back to those quantifiable goals and milestones, targets, et cetera. So where we're at is the framework was adopted by the Board of Water and Soil Resources in June of 2013. We've contracted with the University of Minnesota to assist us in the inventory, assessment, and evaluation and development of the methods for this prioritized target and measurability exercise that each plan area will have to go through. Guiding principles and a draft boundary map were adopted in December of 2013 by the Board. We have a pilot watershed request for interest out right now that was initiated in February of 2014. Will end April 21st with the goal of selecting four pilot watersheds to move forward with in June of 2014. And with the goal then is initiating the permanent program in December of 2015, using those pilots to help inform and learn and test a number of different operating procedures that we will be developing, which will guide and be really the set the requirements for the individual plans. I just wanted to take the last little bit of my time and talk a little bit about and kind of this conceptualizing what we mean when we talk about prioritized, targeted, measurable, because it is going to be one of the really key fundamental differences between what we're doing now with our existing water planning efforts and really making big improvements in this area. And so when we talk about prioritization, this is actually the Pomme de Terre River in west central Minnesota. This is a nitrogen loading map. This is what comes out of the PCA RAPS, or the Watershed Restoration Protection Strategies documents. This one happens to be for nitrogen loading. And you can see it targets those sub-watersheds where they are showing through their modeling where the highest nitrogen loading is compared to areas of lower nitrogen loading. So from the standpoint, if you're going to prioritize, it's the idea of how do we prioritize these sub-areas based on these nutrient loadings, in this case, nitrogen. Yes?
If we could just hold for a second.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt, but he can finish, and then
okay. Why don't you finish this sub-watershed, and then we will.
Okay, two slides. Then moving on from that prior, you know, from the prioritizing, what do we mean when we talk about targeting? And this is an example actually from Lime Creek in the state of Illinois. And it's a case where it shows where they took a nitrogen load reduction and they looked at where they could implement controlled drainage projects, erosion control, water detention or retention projects, as well as improve and increase riparian functions. And basically that's looking at buffers. Where did they need to install them and where did they need to improve the efficiency of those buffers that are already in place for nitrogen assimilation? And this is the kind of thing that when we talk about targeting at the subwatershed level, we expect to get to this level of identifying specific practices and specific locations, and then being able to tie those back to, well, how if we implemented all of those, how much of that goal or target is being reduced? And this is just a hypothetical situation where it shows basically a graph where you might have the existing condition and then what would be the after constructed condition to see if we're actually achieving those reductions. So that's kind of conceptually what we talk about when we use the word measurable in these plans. And that's the end of kind of where we're going with the One Watershed, One Plan program.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that I've been wrestling with a little bit is, you know, DNR has got a program now dealing with groundwater and groundwater management areas. In your mind, how do you see the interaction between groundwater management and the One Watershed, One Plan, or watershed-based surface water management?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's I think largely going to be an issue of scale oftentimes. If the groundwater management is very small and happens to be located entirely within a surface watershed, then probably will happen very simultaneously. But in areas where they're going to be much larger, it's really those goals and objectives that come out of that groundwater management area in terms of what are those things that are needed to, you know, either protect the quantity of water or potentially deal with the quality of the water. Those kinds of strategies then we expect to be taken, brought into that discussion at that watershed planning level and build in, well, what are those local actions that might be able to be designed and implemented that help achieve the goals that are going to come out of the groundwater management area plans? Because some of those are going to, you know, be multiple, cross over multiple watersheds, because our groundwater systems obviously don't match up very well in all places with our surface water systems.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I have mixed feelings about how we're going to proceed here, because we've been really trying to kind of simplify and focus our efforts based on watershed boundaries. And if we add this new layer of groundwater management areas that are on completely different boundaries and actually may be very complex as you go through the geologic stratification of groundwater reservoirs under even just one piece of ground, it gets really complicated really quickly, and I'm not sure that we want to make things more complicated. I guess I didn't have a question in there, but thank you.
You know, I'm not sure, Representative Torkelson, that we're making it more complicated. I think nature gave us a complication, and we're having to deal with it that maybe we hadn't discussed before. So we're all just beginning to understand the geology of our state, which is, my guess, a lot more complex than the geology of a lot of other states. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Along those same lines, I attended the first DNR meeting up in the Bonanza Valley with water sustainability. And they're also getting into the area of water quality. And to me, those are two separate issues in terms of how much water is there and then the quality. And you talk about you're into the water quality and improving the water. And now we've added the DNR to that mix as well. And I would agree with Representative Torkelson that it's a complicated issue. We have a lot of state agencies now involved in both the sustainability and the quality aspect, and I'm just concerned that the expertise is there, that they can work with all of these different aspects.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think one of the concepts that we're developing within the One Watershed, One Plan is also developing project teams that are made up of the agency experts that will be assigned to and support participation and development of the One Watershed, One Plans, which again are local government plans, in terms of how they're going to organize, how they're going to prioritize and allocate resources and, you know, do the things that they do in terms of protection of those. I think that concept will help us bridge those gaps, because certainly when you've got nitrogen in groundwater and pesticides, that falls over to authorities largely vested with the Department of Ag. And then when you come to quantity of groundwater, it largely falls over to the Department of the DNR. And then you also have that surface water groundwater interaction, where if, you know, nitrogen is getting into the shallow groundwater, which is getting into the streams, then it becomes a surface water quality issue, and those kinds of things are actually being looked at and are, you know, assessed during the development by PCA of these 10-year watershed strategy and the development of those RAPs. So I think, you know, one of our goals is to really also get the agencies formally committed to supporting and working with those local governments as we, as they organize and as they develop a One Watershed, One Plan approach in their area.
That was a good answer. I appreciate that. Just back to the pomme de terre, when you were looking at that, I canoed a long piece of the pomme de terre this summer. It was not where I drowned my cell phone. But one of my observations about that was the only thing I saw on the banks was reed canary grass. And it was just all over the place. So you could see that the shallow roots of the grass and understand why we were having such sediment loads, just because there was nothing there to hold the ground in place. And so I think that's adds to your challenge of working in this kind of area, is also understanding what is there holding the ground in place or not. And this is a case of or not. So is this part of what PCA is actually looking at as it targets or does its prioritization? I mean, how does that fit in?
Madam Chair, the condition of the riparian zone is looked at a little bit, in part as one of the things that is different than the traditional kind of small-scale TMDLs moving to this large-scale watershed, is they do look at biological stressors as part of the inventory and assessment work. And in some cases, you know, monotypic vegetation, you know, can in fact, you know, if it's leading to increased bank erosion, can become actually a biological stressor because of sediment in the river and how that, you know, impacts fisheries and fish spawning habitat and things like that. I think, you know, moving ahead, thinking from a strategy perspective, one of the things is also looking at how do you enhance existing riparian areas that are already there and already vegetated to do a better job of doing those things like nitrogen assimilation with, you know, different vegetation, deeper rooted plants, as well as maybe changing and modifying that to actually improve some of the bank stability.
Good. I don't see any other questions. Not good presentations, very strong. Representative Falk, do you have minutes to talk to us about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the minutes from March 4th and March 6th.
Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I just want to note that on the minutes of March 4th that it noted we adjourned at 10:03 a.m. And I just would like to have a discussion. I may have the wrong day. It may have been March 5th. I can't remember which one. But Do we intend, will you let members know if we're going to run over? Many of us, our LA schedule appointments at 10 a.m., which is 15 minutes past the time of adjournment, and I think a time when somebody else has a room reserved. I just think it would be beneficial if we'd know, do we intend to overrun consistently, or is there a chance that you can let us know, ideally the day before or the day of, if we're going to be overrunning and if there's going to be votes after our normal adjournment time so we could make our appointments on time? Because I know specifically sometimes we'll get to our office and the people have already left and I feel bad, but I kind of don't like leaving the meeting early either. So I just thought I'd note it because Representative Falk moved the minutes, and the minutes do note the time of adjournment.
Well, we will make sure that we schedule evening meetings, so if we run over a minute, we can come back in the evening. Representative Falk has moved the minutes of which ones?
I moved both March 4th and March 6th.
March 4th and March 6th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. Meetings adjourned.